Chapter 13. The magic of stories, or so Kiss and Melchizedek and Anne Meeks had taught, lay in making them one's own. The infinite settings and plot twists told, after all, a personal tale, the tale of trial and possibility, of chance encounters with characters who were purveyors of epiphany and keepers of dreams, their influence clear only when remembered across the repeating spiral of time. During Tool's Seattle stop on the 2002 Lateralis tour, Maynard and Steele had spent a long-overdue evening recalling their time on Pearson Street and plotting their next adventures. "He told me he wanted to start a new band," Steele would recall of their talk in the tour bus. "He told me about this Pussifer idea, the fun and different music he wanted to do." Maynard had released angst and anger, had exorcised, through his lyrics, his personal demons. It was time to take another direction, a road that paralleled Tool's, but one that would give free rein to his creativity. It was time to honor the story of hope and survival, of the uniquely human ability to co-create the universe. "I wanted to do something serious, almost as a religion, in reverence to where we've come from," he would explain. And Pussifer, the multifaceted project he'd envisioned more than a decade before, would be his vehicle.
"Long time ago, people understood that the only thing that kept them alive was coordinating in groups and being more creative than the creatures that were threatening them. They were never going to be stronger or faster than those creatures, so they had to be smarter. We're losing touch with that, because everything we need is readily available. You can't walk 10 feet in any direction without running into food, shelter, or clothing. I feel like art has taken a back seat. The whole creative process seems kind of odd because we don't think it's relevant to keeping us alive. But we need to use every fiber of our imagination, every spark of our creative energy, to stay ahead of what's happening to our planet, to our relationships, and to our ability to think for ourselves. Life is too short not to create something with every breath we draw."
"I didn't see Maynard that much," Laura Milligan would recall of the years he'd busied himself with Tool and APC and the Vineyard. "But every time I did, he would say, 'We had to do this, we had to do that, we needed to put together something like what we'd done at Tantrum.' He was always brewing that idea." Pussifer would be an homage to art, he told her. Pussifer would be sound and color, country and rock, and symphony and jazz, costume and story and non sequitur, a friction-driven work in progress, open-ended to leave room for surprise. The revolving troupe might include actors and comedians, guitarists and vocalists, and sound engineers who had become, over the years, family. He'd reprise his Billy Dee character, the roué in wig and mustache, and Laura and her cowgirl boots. Pussifer would be the cabaret at the crossroads of Joseph Campbell and Hee Haw and Sonny and Cher. Pussifer would be funny. "I was losing touch with the comedy part," Maynard would explain. "That's why Pussifer had to come back in a big way. If you want to follow me as an artist, you have to laugh. You have to stop taking yourself so seriously." Fans had appreciated, or at least tolerated, the humorous elements of his work. The padded bras and kabuki makeup, his blowing paper towels at guest drummer Cody Willis mid-song during the 10,000 Days tour, the irreverent Reverend Maynard. Once they were let in on the joke, they had delighted in the Teutonic chants and the Vineyard's suggestive name. But they'd never been forgiving of a comedy routine as part of a live show. Tool's audience at the Hollywood Palladium in 1998 had been impatient for the show to begin, no matter how entertaining the opening act. They were mildly amused when Bob Odenkirk and David Cross stepped to the stage in surgical garb, examined Maynard, and diagnosed him with the rare disease titillitis. But by the time Maynard was draped in a hospital johnny and guided to a wheelchair, they'd had enough and chanted their insistent demand for the main event. But Maynard had known that silliness should be integral to his act ever since he'd catapulted hot dogs to the English acid crowd. "At the time, it looked like misspent time, like so many things he did," Jack Olson would remember. "In retrospect, of course, It all seems to line up beautifully toward what eventually happened. Mounting such an ambitious effort would take a pro, and Maynard realized that Matt Mitchell was the right man for the job. Mitchell came in with not only the technical skills to produce recordings and videos, but a background with video game developer Electronic Arts, and he understood the importance of schedules and deadlines and practical details. Matt is the steady, grounded piece of this puzzle, Maynard would explain. While I'm out there like a kite, he's the one hanging on to it. And in 2007, Pussifer was launched in all its punk-inspired purity, an independent band with no sponsorship and no obligation to recording industry dictates. Maynard and Matt created not only lyrics but arrangements, incorporating rhythm machines and techno programming and digital soundscapes, echoes of the delay pedal effects and Mike Ming's drum machine at Gaia's decades before. It's very refreshing to work with someone who's open to experimenting and allows me to experiment as well, Matt explained in a 2016 interview. Maynard's always looking for the next thing. He looks at every pebble and asks, "Where do I leap from here?" In spare moments during the last leg of the 10,000 Days tour, Matt set up his laptop and worked with the cadre of musicians and writers and vocalists to ready Pussifer's first songs for the final mix. APC's self-recording of Mère de Nantes in 2000 had been big news at the time, but 7 years later, it had become commonplace and economical for bands to take the independent approach.
Back in the day, a band would have to sell at least a half million records before they saw a profit. But now music can be as sustainable as winemaking. We can have far fewer sales and still pay the rent because there's no middleman, no bunch of executives in the way, nobody sticking their finger in the pie.
And in those days of MTV and music magazines and a brick-and-mortar record store in every mall, new recordings had been spoon-fed directly to consumers. What musicians did then, we could not do now, Maynard would explain. Without that machine in place, people have to discover music in other ways. The internet, the go-to information source of the digital generation, had enabled real-time promotion, bringing news far more quickly than print publications could go to press. The public would generate the Pussifer buzz. The group's first single, Queen Bee, was released as a video and a podcast on Pussifer.com, priming fans for the release in late October of its first album, V is for Vagina, and assuring its debut spot at number 25 on the Billboard 200. The Pussifer team broadened its reach with pages on MySpace and Facebook, allowing fans to discuss this new trip-hop phenomenon and, more important, spread word of their discoveries and upcoming releases. Pussifer followers logged on one morning in early 2009 and discovered a comedic video announcing the group's long-awaited live debut. Maynard, in full military regalia as the stern, pedantic, and quirky Major Douche, took questions from a largely clueless press corps about what they might expect from the show. He promised nothing less than shock and awe. The screen above the stage brightened to reveal Major Douche, service cap in one hand, flask in the other. He stood before an oversized American flag, glared at the concert goers, and barked orders to silence all cell phones and stow all cameras. The sold-out Valentine's Day weekend shows were not the elaborate production Maynard fans had expected. The Pearl Concert Theater at the Palms Casino in Las Vegas was set with Tim Alexander's and Gil Sharon's drum kits and Ronnie Sharon's bass, floor stand mics for Maynard and Juliette Comagère, and suspended over the stage, her eyes staring straight into the crowd, was the image of the Queen Bee herself, Miss Pussifer. And Maynard stepped to the stage. The crowd was on its feet at once, caught up in the cacophony of opener Uncle Scratch's gospel revival, the rockabilly duo of Brother Ant and Brother Ed, and their chaos of bullhorns and percussion section of cardboard tubes and cartons. The show segued from sketch comedy to video to song, song that ascended in eastern ululation, dipped in guttural chants, slowed in sultry R&B rhythms that evoked a summer night in Motown. Maynard's rich, clear voice rose in rap and blues and pure rock. He was the impassioned tent revivalist, urging his flock to transcend dogma and recognize the earthly paradise. Then, in a sharp left turn, a lounge singer delivering his paean to the erotic. Maynard has to be one of the most idiosyncratic frontmen that rock has ever had, music writer Steve Morse would explain. He's a puzzle. But under it all, there's a consistency and a need to communicate. He challenges us to examine our idea of a frontman. The company came together in layered harmonies, parted for solos and duets, joined again in the trance-like Indigo Children, and then cleared center stage for Mila Jovovich's solo of The Ways of the Underside, her scarlet dress shimmering against the monochromatic set. It was a vaudeville show for the 21st century, Alexander said. If the vineyard was the quest, the struggle, Pussifer was the dance that followed, the celebration of song and laughter that continued in a wash of colored strobes long into the night. Pussifer's debut triggered in Maynard a burst of productivity. Only 5 months after the group's live launch, he was back on the road with Tool for a mini-tour that included the Mile High Music Festival in Colorado and Lollapalooza 2009 at Chicago's Grant Park. And following the November release of its EP, C is for, please insert sophomoric genitalia reference here, Pussifer was off again across the U.S. and Canada. For much of the next 2 years, Maynard took his turn now with Tool, now with APC, again with Pussifer, in a round-robin of tours across the U.S., Canada, New Zealand, and Australia. I remember him coming home from a long tour, Tim Alexander would recall. I had lunch with him the next day, and he told me he'd been out in the vineyard at 6 a.m. picking grapes. That's why he creates success in his life. He puts in everything he has. With Chris and Lei Lee at the helm, the vineyard was in good hands during his absences, but Maynard used his time on the road to his advantage. Concerts were an opportunity to cross-market his varied brands, he realized, to raise awareness of his Sangioveses and Cabernets. With Maynard, there's so much complexity. He's not just a musician or a songwriter, Nancy Berry would explain. He's a very astute businessman with an entrepreneurial spirit. A ticket upgrade admitted fans early for the pre-show VIP wine tasting, a Caduceus 101 course in assessing bouquet and balance and finish. Maynard delegated classroom duty to the best man for the job, the man who'd sat beside him at tastings and pairing dinners from the beginning. He needed someone to teach fans how to interpret wine, Todd would explain. So now the security guy teaches the wine course. Pussifer's second full album, Conditions of My Parole, debuted at number 27 on Billboard's 200 list in October 2011. Recorded among the barrels in the bunker when the tour schedule allowed, the collection was an ode to the Verde Valley in all its contradiction. The album brought together original ensemble members and newcomers, including British vocalist Karina Round, drummer Jeff Friedel, bassist Matt McJunkins, keyboard player Josh Eustace, and Devo on cello. The Conditions tour kicked off with a Halloween appearance on Late Night with David Letterman, the infectious energy inspiring music director Paul Schaefer to break into a spirited keyboard rendition of the title track. At last, Maynard had solved the dilemma of rock and comedy sharing the stage. Pussifer was, after all, theater, and he wisely booked venues designed for just that. A 15,000-seat auditorium would never provide the intimacy a variety show demanded, but conservatory auditoriums would fit the bill, and historic performance houses that had been stops on the circuits of 19th-century lecturers and Shakespeare companies and vaudeville troupes.
The beauty of Pussifer is going into theaters, where there are ushers, and not the rock clubs that people are used to. The unfamiliar form throws audiences off their normal game. They're out of their element. because they have to sit in their own seat, and they get chastised for pulling out a camera or invading someone else's space. It's like boot camp for them, breaking them down to build them back up so they can pay attention and appreciate what's happening in front of them.
The spaces were ornate with Corinthian pilasters and gilt-edged balconies and pastoral paintings above the stages, but the mood was anything but reserved. Pussifer is a many-faceted building with many cornerstones, Maynard would explain. The first is to remember to have fun. Remember to dance, to follow your bliss. And the fun began before the theater doors opened. As fans queued on the sidewalk, Brother Ed strode among them, and zealous as any street preacher, implored them to turn away from sin, to avoid the show and save their hell-bound souls. The house lights dimmed, and Maynard pulled an aluminum airstream from the wings. Karina stepped from the trailer and helped him arrange a charcoal grill and lawn chairs at the edge of the proscenium, and a red and white draped table set with bottles and goblets. While the players awaited their turns in the spotlight, they sat in a circle and sipped wine, the orange paper flames of the barbecue fluttering toward the sky. Conditions of My Parole was smooth guitar and ominous chant, curious electronic distortion and melodic harmony, lowbrow humor and linguistic play, rock and country and karaoke in a trailer park. In Maynard's shows, you come off this rush of intensity, and then it's him coming out of an airstream, Steele would explain. He's a combination of the spiritual and then, here, have a dish of fish food. The performance was punctuated by video interludes that told the story of eccentric desert dwellers, the crass and bumbling Billy Dee, Hill Dee in crop top and leopard print kimono, Peter Merkin and his infatuation with conspiracy theories and Debbie Gibson. Concertgoers began to suspect there was more to the skits than tales of make-believe people. The characters seemed somehow familiar. No different, really, from the dreamers and the downtrodden and the wannabe bass players they'd known, the uncle who every year dominated Thanksgiving dinner with rants about dope sniffers. Maynard's lyrics of echoes and ghosts and omens could have been about the fears and passions of real people just like them, their ambiguity and invitation to make the stories their own and to accept their part in their creation. Pussifer works through the whole chakra system, Laura Milligan would say to the show's format. You go through the entire gamut of human experience. You have that connection with your belly and your first chakra. You get silly and laugh, and then you move up to that beautiful place at the end when he's just soaring with Karina and the mandolins. Maynard's intense scream, unrelenting stare, and bold lyrics had gotten the public's attention. And they couldn't stop listening now, when his art had become more complex and multi-layered. Steele had recognized Maynard's spiritual depth, but it could never be said that the man who'd sung Fuck Your Christ embraced mainstream religious views. He and Ramiro had discovered in their long-ago late-night discussions Joseph Campbell's concept of religio, a linking back, a reconnection with ancient mythologies, not through blind belief in parroted dogma, but an understanding of their practical purpose.
Religion helps explain important information so it's easy to understand and doesn't have to be explained every time. People living in the desert thousands of years ago couldn't eat pork because it was full of worms, and they'd die if they ate it. In order to keep people from eating it, it became a religious prescription, and then avoiding it just became part of the daily routine. They don't think about the survival mechanism attached to the ritual. Why don't we eat pork? Don't worry about it, just don't eat pork. Japanese tea ceremony started because if there's a tsunami, boiling the water purifies it so it's safe to drink. It became a part of their religion to boil the water. We just casually make these things part of our daily routine so that when a tsunami hits, at least our family might survive, almost accidentally, because our ritual taught us how to boil water and drink that instead of contaminated water. Honoring that ritual is heaven, the knowledge of good and evil. Is salvation.
The searchers and seekers and mastodon fleers of the old stories, he and Ramiro had learned, were but characters in one story with infinite variations, eternally replicating the human tale of possibility and survival. Karina in her black gown, Maynard in his Italian suit or his cowboy costume, Friedel at his drum kit, the story was repeated once more. The crowd sat as rapt as magi, pitched to a weightlessness beneath projections of swirling stars and the moon that floated fat and full in the desert sky. The conditions team brought on board musicians Zach Ray, Josh Moreau, and Claire Acey to record 2013's Donkey Punch the Night, an EP of two new songs and their techno remixes, and a Pussifer treatment of Accept's Balls to the Wall and Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody. In the early days of CAD, Maynard had vowed he'd never take the easy way out, and tackling Queen's masterpiece reminded him that he'd kept his promise. Retracking Bohemian Rhapsody almost note for note forced me to pay attention to its complex harmonies and multiple movements, he explained. It reminded me of how I'd always believed music should be approached. I've never stuck to that simple intro-verse-chorus-bridge format. If Mitchell was a grounding influence, so too was Maynard's time on the mat. He'd begun each winter to join interested high school wrestlers in the MCC gym, assisting coach Jim Allen in teaching them the fundamentals just as Mike had taught them, the pure math and physics of the leverage the sport demanded. And he didn't stop there. He helped fund the team's summer wrestling camp retreat and let them know the gift came with a price. I had them write essays, he would explain. I asked them to tell what wrestling means to them, or why wrestling should be kept in the Olympics. Maynard's level of give back is amazing, Steele said. I imagine him telling the wrestlers, don't let anyone tell you what you should do. Find the things that make you healthy and happy. But then he would probably add, and if you haven't seen the Will Ferrell movie Old School, you're doing yourself a disservice. He always does some form of comedy. And in 2015, during a long overdue vacation, Maynard visited Limau Heredia's Maui Jiu-Jitsu Academy, the island's premier Brazilian jiu-jitsu school. It had been a long time since he'd studied under Heredia at the Gracie Academy, and their reunion would be a chance to train with him again. I was honored that after 20 years Maynard came to see me, Heredia said in a 2015 interview. On their second afternoon of training, Heredia turned to Maynard. In his hands he held a purple belt, the level in Brazilian jiu-jitsu signifying conscious competence. He'd earned the belt because he's tough, Heredia would explain. He's capable and focused and a good student. But I also wasn't going to pass up the chance to thank him for all he's done for jiu-jitsu. His involvement brought an awareness of the sport. How many musicians and fans are studying jiu-jitsu because of Maynard? Deb Rockman had looked forward to Pussifer's Chicago performance as much to celebrate her former student's success as to forget for an evening a time of too much illness and death, too much grief. It had been a difficult, difficult year, she explained in a 2013 interview. I emailed Maynard and poured my heart out to him, and he opened his heart and listened to me. And that night at the Cadillac Palace, Maynard's voice rose in a hymn of beauty and peace, of surrender to the healing rhythm of the sea, the cleansing waves that gather, then break across the sand. He sang of the hope that remains in the wake of sorrow. He sang the song he dedicated that night to Rockman.
Weary traveler, calloused and sore, time and gravity followed you here. Rest, my sister, and tell me all about the ocean. Spoils and troubles and burdens you bore, pay them no mind, they matter no more. Leave them behind and show me all about the ocean. Look in your eyes. I've never seen an ocean. Not like this one.
How else could his fan base get exposed to such ideas? Moon Zappa would reflect. It's miraculous. And he does it in a relatable way, with sound and light and artistry. He's an alchemist and a wizard for sure. A merry trickster. The merry trickster, quite unbeknownst to Lei Li, booked the underground bar of Louisville's Sealback Hotel for the afternoon of Pussifer's Leap Day show. And after a 30-year gap in communication, he invited his Church of the Brethren pastor, Paul Grout, to join him for brunch at the neighborhood before Tool's Boston performance in January. He had important arrangements to discuss. Pussifer's success was due in great part to Lely, who had taken on filling customer orders and managing the Pussifer store in Jerome, where fans stocked up on T-shirts and posters, vinyl and CDs, locally roasted coffee beans, and squid ink pasta. At last, she'd put her art degree to good use in designing Pussifer's women's clothing line, and Maynard relied on her to assemble tour merch and to arrange for flights and shuttle buses and meatless meals for the vegetarians in the cast. Lely got things done. She'd never been dazzled by Maynard's celebrity. The respect and admiration she'd felt for him from the beginning had only grown stronger, but happy in her work and fully aware of his dalliances, she'd kept her professional distance. "I definitely didn't want to jeopardize my job," she would recall. "If he didn't reciprocate my feelings, it could be awkward." But the more evenings she spent with him, the more Thanksgiving pizzas they shared, the more old friends and family she met over cream of wheat before a show, the harder it was to deny what her heart was telling her. Meanwhile, Maynard looked forward to returning from the road or a long day in the bunker and finding her there to share Cabernet and a discussion of the finer points of Carlos Castaneda. Lely had become more than an employee, more, even, than a trusted sister. And there came the day when he recognized in her the one person who could catch his glance from across the room, smile with him at the inside joke, stand beside him in the face of all possibility. He'd fallen, to his surprise, in love.
"You had to lose your way to find your way back. I reached the point where I needed to stop going down the wrong path because the only thing I saw was that there's nothing to it. You're never going to find connection or love or commitment in transient relationships. It's like in Charlotte's Web. You see some pig, and you forget that actually the spider pointed it out and the pig is nothing. You're looking for the web and the spider, and you get distracted by the pig. Several pigs. I don't regret a single step I took down that road. I learned a lot about myself and turned those experiences into something positive, into songs and art. In the words of Bill Hicks, in this business, it takes a very special woman, or a lot of average ones. I finally understood what he meant. Meanwhile, in the distance, you have Lely going, 'Fuck, finally.'"
Above the bar at the Rotskeller, in the basement of the Seelbach Hotel, gold leaf signs of the Zodiac glinted in the candlelight. The space was lined floor to vaulted ceiling with hand-painted rookwood tiles depicting scenes of apple orchards and walled cities, and about the old speakeasy, sturdy pillars were encircled with pottery pelicans, a symbol of good luck. Maynard hadn't told Lely the details of his plan until the stage had been set. He'd left her just enough time to choose a gown and visit the florist, and after a 2-year engagement, presented her with a perfectly choreographed afternoon. And while the band performed the soundcheck before that night's show, they slipped away to the Rotskeller to be married. The winding path, the switchbacks and wrong turns and detours had inexorably led to this, Maynard's bride in beribboned gown, her bouquet of red roses, her smile as he came near. Jan was there, and Lely's parents, Pussifer's tour manager, Todd, a photographer, and the Reverend Grout. "Our long-ago connection was meaningful to Maynard, and it was meaningful to me too," he said of his agreement to travel from Vermont to perform the ceremony. "I thought he was pretty amazing back then, and I was struck that he'd carried that uniqueness for so long. The fact that he remembered the things I'd told him was touching." Maynard and Lely listened to Grout's words of the joys and challenges and necessary forgiveness they would share. Then Maynard looked into her eyes and she into his, and they whispered their vows. "Then we went to the Brown Theater and threw the garter and bouquet to the band," Lely would remember, "and shared cupcakes with everyone." The two-week stay in Italy was as much a research project as a honeymoon. Maynard and Lely had visited Piemonte vineyards, the terraced Barolo and Barbaresco acres near Alba, and next on the itinerary would be a stop at Luca Corrado's Vietti Winery in Castiglione Falletto. "I'd met Corrado at a wine distributor meeting in Denver years before," Maynard would explain. "We hit it off and kept in contact." Corrado led the newlyweds through his cellar, fed them wine and cheese, and Maynard, in a rush of Midwestern gregariousness, told him of their plans for the next day. They'd hire a driver and explore, he explained, and search for details of Spirito Marzo and Clementina D'Urbiano, his great-grandparents, who, according to vague family stories, had been married somewhere in the Val di Susa more than a century before. If Maynard needed assistance in his sleuthing, Corrado and his wife Elena were just the pair to help. Corrado knew Susa well, he said, had skied there often, and with the town's chief of police, no less. After a few flurried phone calls, Elena reported that Maynard's ancestors weren't from Susa at all, but nearby Venaus, and he and Lely were expected at the Venaus archives the next day. And on the morning of his 48th birthday, Maynard tucked a bottle of wine under his arm and stepped from the narrow street and into the municipio, bustling that morning with Venausians filing papers and investigating titles and resolving their municipal matters. "I figured we were in the right place," Maynard would recall. "The nameplate on the counter said Ariana Marzo." Ariana waved them toward an adjoining room, where Maynard saw not the bulging file cabinets and musty ledgers he'd expected, but a trio of national and local reporters, the mayor, and a cluster of townsfolk who greeted him with a hearty, "Hello! Welcome home!" On the table was stacked all the information Maynard could have hoped for. Maps and addresses, and copies of birth certificates and death certificates, and marriage licenses of Boniface Spirito Giacinto Marzo and Maria Clementina D'Urbiano, and of their daughter, Maria Luigia Ernestina Marzo, his grandmother. A visit from an American rock star was the most exciting thing to happen in the little town in quite some time, particularly a rock star with local roots. The next day, the newspapers would include spreads detailing Maynard's visit and his family tree, a tree that branched to include most of the people in Venaus. Even Mayor Nilo D'Urbiano was family, they discovered, a cousin on Clementina's side, and they toasted in Nahual del Marzo their unexpected reunion. It wasn't surprising that so many shared common ancestors. Surviving the harsh alpine winters had never been easy, and people of the region had decades before relied on the bounty of neighboring villages to get them by until springtime. While blizzards raged over the mountains, the Marzos and the D'Urbianos had donned heavy coats and boots and mittens and scarves, tied bundles to their sleds, journeyed down the snowy peaks, and met their neighbors in the valley, where they exchanged food and supplies. "When it came time to get married," Maynard would explain, "they picked a partner who could handle that trek." And Spirito, like so many others, chose as his wife a strong, capable woman he'd met on the wintry path. He chose Clementina D'Urbiano, a woman of the journey. Through the narrow streets they rode, to the edge of town and up a steep incline that brought them face to face with the house. Its stonework had crumbled, its windows were long shattered, the roof was black with decay. But this was the house all the same, the house where Maynard's great-great-grandfather, great-grandfather, and grandmother had been born, where Marzos and D'Urbianos had celebrated Christmases and opened their windows to the first springtime day, where they'd told stories and sung songs and shared a glass or two of Spirito's wine. Before the door rose precarious stone steps, steps Spirito and Clementina and baby Luisa had climbed, and Maynard and Lely rested there. In the distance were sun-washed green hills, and farther, snow-capped mountains, and across the narrow street, a weathered wooden fence laced with grapevines.
It all unfolded because of that one connection I made in Denver 5 years before. It happened because I kept in touch and opened my mouth at the right time. I had put my faith in just going. And then people put the pieces together that led me right to where I was supposed to go. And my family was waiting for me.
Maynard stood in the wings of the Greek Theater. He watched them arrive, singers and musicians, comics, family and friends, and a capacity audience. They'd come to L.A. for Chiquanta, a celebration of his 50th birthday. The evening was a wave of contagious energy that spanned decades and generations, a seamless segue from failure to a perfect circle to Pussifer. Boundaries blurred as the players changed partners in the spiraling dance. Karina stepped to the mic on APC's The Package. Failure's Kelly Scott and APC's Jeff Friedel collaborated in a drum duo. Maynard lifted his voice in the second verse of Failure's The Nurse Who Loved Me. And Billy Howerdell joined him on Pussifer's Monsoons. And when Justin Chancellor opened the Tool favorite Sober, or Matt McJunkins kicked off APC's Orestes, the crowd took its part and sang every word. And the evening was Devo, his dark wavy hair framing his solemn face, in his debut solo before so large an audience, his cello shimmering in the splash of white light. Green Jello burst on the stage in all its masked chaos, Manspeaker a looming big bad wolf, and his son Damien a player in oversized puppet head. "I was so nervous," Manspeaker would recall. "There's all these serious songs about changing your life in positive ways, and I've got a song about pigs." But the act was integral to the show's circling to a long-ago evening at Hollywood High. Manspeaker howled, little pig, let me come in," and Maynard delivered his falsetto response, his gold record response, "Not by the hair of my chinny chin chin." The moshing pigs exited the stage, and Laura Milligan stepped out as Hildy. She summoned Billy Dee from the Airstream, and Maynard, in leisure suit and wig, joined her in the old Libertyville campfire song, Country Boner, while Danny kept the beat. "We've been able to stay together as long as we have because of the trust in each other," he would explain. "The end product will always be something more than the sum of the parts." Chiquanta was just that, a collective of sound more complex and nuanced for the selfless collaboration.
A show like that is not possible if people are unable to set aside their egos. It works when they look at a bigger common goal. Each band played pieces from their own heart and soul and then transitioned to the next set of people who shared each other's work. It made me want to do it all over again so even more people could feel this. That kind of magic can happen if you pay attention to where you are and where you're going and where you've been.
They stood together, Maynard and Devo, Karina and Matt Mitchell, Jeff and Matt McJunkins and Billy, Danny and Juliette Comagère and Justin and Laura, Todd and Lay Lee and Manspeaker and his family in the wings. They formed an arc across the stage, and the audience completed the circle's circumference. Their harmonies filled the night, and the gibbous moon rose higher in the sky.
Nature, nurture, heaven, and home. Some of all and by them driven, to conquer every mountain shown. But I've never crossed the river. Brave the forests, brave the stone, brave the icy winds and fire. Braved and beat them on my own. Yet I'm helpless by this river. Angel, angel, what have I done? I faced the quakes, the wind, the fire. I've conquered country, crown, and throne. Why can't I cross this river? Pay no mind to the battles you've won. It'll take a lot more than rage and muscle. Open your heart and hands, my son, or you'll never make it over the river. It'll take a lot more than words and guns, a whole lot more than riches and muscle. The hands of the many must join as one. And together we'll cross the river.